Hello, this is Bob Kruger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food for June 2010. June is National Dairy Month. The last couple of years have been hard on dairies, and the price of milk has been lower than the farmer's cost in many cases. While we enjoy the price of milk in our stores being lower, we need to be concerned about the source of that milk. Forecasts had called for milk prices to go up, but as yet that doesn't seem to be the case. For many of us, dairy products, milk, cheese, yogurt, and so forth, are the main sources of calcium. But for some, dairy products carry a good bit of fat. Most cheeses contain a good bit of fat, as does whole milk and 2% milk. It is recommended we use either 1% milk or skim milk. Make the change to a less fat milk will require an adjustment in our taste buds, but we've done it. Even now, 2% milk tastes strange. The question has been asked, what's better for you, cow's milk or goat's milk? Nutritionally speaking, cow's milk and goat's milk are pretty much the same. Goat's milk has a little less cholesterol and a bit more protein, fat, and calcium. Generally speaking, people are attracted to goat's milk not because it's nutritionally superior, but for other reasons. For one, some people find it easier to digest than cow's milk, and people with stomach problems or ulcers find it to be a satisfactory alternative to cow's milk. For another reason, quite a few people who are allergic to cow's milk can tolerate goat's milk. In a study of 2,000 people with food allergies, 43.7% were found to be allergic to cow's milk, while only 2.6% were allergic to goat's milk. Goat milk is excellent for babies. The milk from goats doesn't have to be homogenized because the fat globules in milk are much smaller than in cow's milk. Goat's milk, therefore, does not separate as rapidly as cow's milk. Many people are afraid to try it because they've heard that it has an offensive taste. This is not true if the milk is properly handled and kept cold. Incidentally, it takes 10 goats to produce as much milk as one cow, and about 1 million dairy goats in the United States today. Many of what are often called gourmet cheeses are made from goat's milk. Some are produced locally. One example is a celebrity dairy located near Siler City. My favorite goat milk-based cheese is feta cheese, which originated in Greece. It's very good, crumbled and sprinkled over a fresh green salad. Most of us like cheese, but many varieties of cheese carry good amounts of both salt and fat. So again, we recommend you read the labels. A number of companies are marketing lower fat and lower sodium cheeses in shredded, sliced, or chunk forms. Let's take a look at what those low salt and low sodium labels mean. The federal government is specific about sodium labels. To carry the label salt-free, 1 ounce serving must have less than 5 milligrams of sodium. For very low, less than 35 milligrams of sodium, and low, less than 140 milligrams. Table salt is 40% sodium, and 1 teaspoon of salt has about 2,300 milligrams of soda. The National Academy of Sciences recommend no more than 3,300 milligrams of sodium a day. Salt-restricted diets call for less than 2,000 milligrams of sodium a day. And sodium is an element found naturally in most foods, even drinking water. A medium-sized green pepper has 21 milligrams of sodium, a large egg has 69 milligrams, and a cup of whole milk has 120 milligrams of soda. As milk product, cheese naturally contains sodium. More sodium traditionally is added from the salt used in the cheese-making process to give cheese taste and texture. Some types of cheese already fall below the 140 milligrams per ounce and could be labeled low sodium without changing the cheese. Munster and mozzarella are two examples. The American Heart Association defines low fat as 5 grams of fat or less per ounce. Moderate fat is 8 grams or less. However, reducing fat in cheese is more complicated because fat content helps define cheese types. For example, you can't have a low-fat cheddar because cheddar must have at least 9 grams of fat per ounce or it isn't cheddar. Most cheddars come in mild, medium, and sharp. And the sharp has more fat due to a longer aging process. Wouldn't you know it? I like the sharp variety best. I've often said that I want a cheese with a flavor that snaps back at me when I taste it. There are a number of ways you can limit the amount of cheese in your cooking. For example, instead of making a cheese sauce to serve over broccoli, just shake some Parmesan cheese over the broccoli. This works well, and you get some of that cheese flavor. Dairy products are a primary source of saturated fat in our diets. Two-thirds of the fat in cheese, milk, sour cream, ice cream, butter is saturated fat. That's the bad news. The good news is that there are some cheese imposters on the market now that are really good substitute. Non-dairy cheese is made with rice, nut, or soy milk in place of cow's milk. It contains little, if any, saturated fat, a big improvement over full-fat and even low-fat cheeses. Non-dairy cheeses come in a variety of forms and flavors, too, including Swiss, mozzarella, cheddar, and jack in bricks or shredded. Most importantly, they are a whole lot better than they used to be. Non-dairy cheeses generally don't resemble dairy cheeses well enough to stand alone with a cracker. Still, for general cooking purposes, they're worth keeping on hand. Non-dairy cheese isn't perfect. Like dairy cheese, it's a processed food and relatively high in sodium. It's a substantial improvement. Try it. Although produce seasons have almost eliminated thanks to modern shipping and hydroponic growing, spring asparagus should soon be celebrated in its season. We see asparagus in the produce counter almost year-round, but that that's grown closer to home is available now. And as asparagus lovers know, the vegetable with its delicate taste is a hint of lush days ahead. Asparagus, the aristocrat of vegetables, has long been valued for its delicious flavor. Although it grows wild in many parts of the world, it's been cultivated for at least 2,500 years. The Greeks and Romans not only ate asparagus, but believed that it prevented bee stings, helped heart ailments, dropsy, and toothaches. It was also prized as an aphrodisiac. No one knows whether it was the Dutch or the English who first brought asparagus to this country, but it has been extensively cultivated since the mid-1800s. Why bother with asparagus? Because it tastes so good and it's good for you. Asparagus is very low in calories, a mere 66 calories a pound, but rich in nutrients. It's relatively high in fiber, protein, B vitamins, and trace minerals. And as a rule of thumb, 1 pound of asparagus makes 4 half-cup servings. It's low in sodium and free of saturated fat and cholesterol. When shopping for asparagus, look for firm, crisp, straight stalks with deep red color and closed, compact tips. Pick stalks of a like size so they will cook uniformly. If you're fortunate enough to find a good buy on fresh asparagus, or if you buy more than you can use quickly, you might want to freeze the excess. Freezing doesn't alter its nutritional value, so feel free to eat fresh or frozen. Basic preparation when cooking asparagus is easy, but there's one cardinal rule. Don't overcook it. Wash the stalks well and break and cut off the bottom, tougher part of each stalk. We have a vegetable steamer and steam the stalks. If you do not, put the stalks in a frying pan and cover with water. Cook quickly until tender crisp. Asparagus can be prepared in a microwave oven. The North Carolina Legislative Task Force on Childhood Obesity recently announced 14 recommendations to help make healthy living a way of life for children, from their daily activities to what they eat and do in school. That would save money on health costs in the long run. But in the short run, the next step is to turn proposals into law that would cost the state millions of dollars. The task force endeavor is part of a nationwide effort to address childhood obesity, including Michelle Obama's Let's Move initiative. The recommendations come as public school nutrition programs across the state are struggling to provide healthful food to students in face of rising costs and the temptation to turn to better-selling but less healthy items to help meet the budgets. The committee, composed of 6 members each from the House and the Senate, spent 4 months examining childhood obesity and its impact on the state's schools, health system, and economy. The members reviewed state health numbers and heard testimony from child nutrition, education, and health experts. Many of the recommendations call for more money for school lunchrooms, but with a price tag in the millions, some suggestions will have a difficult time becoming law while the state has limited funds. One recommendation would eliminate the reduced lunch category at a cost of $5.2 million. This would qualify an additional 100,000 students to receive free lunches, according to the School Nutrition Association of North Carolina, and the lunches are partly reimbursed by the federal government. The additional free lunch students would bring in about $5 million more in federal aid. Another proposal calls for increasing breakfast and lunch prices by 5 cents to pay for increased nutritional standards, which have been on the books since 2006, but unfunded because of the rising price of food. Many schools have implemented these standards on their own, but have lost money doing so. The proposals translate into 11 new bills that, if passed, will turn the recommendations into law. Appropriate House and Senate committees will now examine the task force suggestions and the bills drafted from them. Child nutrition officials think these recommendations represented a turn in the right direction for the state. This is a huge step for beginning to make changes needed in communities, in schools, in any venue, said Lynn Harvey, who oversees child nutrition for the Department of Public Instruction. In normal economic times, these proposals might have a chance to become law, but with the state legislature facing a shortfall of millions, it's doubtful how many of these ideas will become law. Do you like watermelon? Hear this. There is something about Katie Mills and watermelons. As a student at Cape Fear High School, she was named North Carolina Watermelon Queen, in part, she says, because of her ability in seed spitting. Now a senior at NC State University, Mills and watermelons are linked again. This time, Mills, 22, has a national platform and a plan to put a watermelon in the gas tank of every car in the United States. When you say that, say it like that, it sounds strange, Mills said, but watermelon as an alternative fuel source makes a lot of sense. This year, Mills won a national speech competition on the subject sponsored by the National Watermelon Association. She was named the young agriculture spokesperson for the group, calling that fits her personality. Her speech focused on research using watermelon rather than corn as a source of ethanol. Studies have shown that the simple sugars in melon juice can be made into ethanol. Since an estimated 20% of the nation's watermelon crop is either left in the fields or fed to hogs because it is deemed unfit for the market, Mills said up to 800 million pounds of fruit could be changed from waste into fuel. A 20-pound melon would give us close to 3/4 of a pound of ethanol, she said. Nationally, that would produce huge amounts of fuel without having to grow any additional crops. The fruit has a chemical advantage over corn, the most common crop used in ethanol production. Corn's complex starches require additional steps in the fermentation process. Anyone who's been around watermelons have sat too long knows that they ferment quickly. It's a small but exciting part of America's ability to become energy independent. I like this concept of using something that's been considered a waste product. It sounds a bit like recycling, which I'm very much in favor of. More power to Katie and her co-workers. Have you ever wondered what chefs look for when they go out to eat? The News and Observer's food writer, Andrea Weigel, did. So she went along as two chefs ate their way around Durham, stopping at 9 restaurants and tasted 33 dishes, including deep-fried catfish, a fried soft-boiled egg, and grits souffle. Her story about that evening is a finalist in the Association of Food Journalists Writing Contest. She's a finalist in two categories, best newspaper food coverage for newspapers with fewer than 150,000 subscribers, and best newspaper food feature in a newspaper with fewer than 200,000 subscribers. The winners will be announced at the group's annual conference in September. The Association of Food Journalists is a professional organization for full-time and freelance food writers. Weigel dishes up more than recipes in the News and Observer's food section. She's written profiles of farmers, chefs, and food artisans, and even chronicled the life of a breed pig from birth to table. She writes stories of interest to foodies as well as coupon clippers. She received another honor recently when she was appointed to a 3-year term on the James Beard Foundation's Book Awards Committee. Cookbook author and television chef James Beard was one of the first advocates for America's regional cuisines. At an annual gala, the foundation hands out awards to chefs, cookbook authors, food writers, and others working in the culinary arts. And Weigel served as the judge for the cookbook contest for 2 of the past 3 years. She's worked at the News and Observer since 2000 and has covered food in the past 3 years. Weigel said she loves covering the Triangle's vibrant food scene. She points to the small-scale sustainable farmers and James Beard-winning chefs, to worthy gas station eating and food trucks that specialize in tacos, burgers, and sweets. I'll share with you one of Andrea stories about a farmer. It reads, by late 1990s, Fred Miller had spent almost 20 years selling Icon office material. He was burned out on sales quota, management meeting, and the regular day-in, day-out corporate grind. One day he read an article in the News and Observer about community-supported agriculture, known as CSA, in which people pay farmers for a weekly share of their crops during the growing season. At that time, only a handful of CSAs were in North Carolina. Miller turned to his wife and said, Virginia, this is what I want to do. Luckily for him, his wife and her two sisters had inherited about 400 acres in southern Wake County. Miller has since carved out 35 acres for Hilltop Farms, the county's first and only certified organic grower. Fred Miller met his wife at East Carolina University, where he got a degree in administration with a concentration in accounting. He jokes, I tell people I still turned out to be a bean counter. The farm is named after Hilltop Road, where the couple lives in a farmhouse that Virginia's grandparents built in 1921. Her sisters live within sight in their own homes, and cousins live up and down the road. Mr. Miller said it was not an easy transition from copier salesman to farmer. We had one little tractor, he said. I didn't have any help, any know-how, any facilities. The first 3 years he farmed after working on weekends, and his first CSA had two members who split a share. He couldn't grow enough to supply this lone pair of CSA members and had to buy produce from other organic growers. The next year my vow was to grow everything myself, and I have ever since, he said. Miller now has about 170 CSA members. He sells at two weekly farmers' markets and from a stand at the farm, offering organic strawberries, blueberries, mustard greens, radishes, lettuce, and more. He also supplies produce to East Carolina Organics, a farm-owned cooperative that sells to retailers and restaurants. As a farmer, he still faces deadlines, franticness, and unhappy customers, but he said, nobody ever thanked me for being a copier salesman. Sounds like a person happy in his work. Walk into a restaurant these days and you might be able to check the calorie count of your enchilada, the salt content of your fries, the health heart status of your Asiago peppercorn steak, and in one pioneering place, the carbon footprint of your vegetable lasagna. Welcome to the era of the menu as a spreadsheet. More restaurants, either by choice or mandate, are bombarding diners with calorie counts, and other information. The disclosures on menus, menu boards, and pamphlets are a victor for health advocates who believe informed consumers will make better food choices. But the profusion of numbers makes one wonder. Is it possible to give diners too much information about their food? At some point, having too much information might actually hurt because it may start to confuse, says Barry Popkin, a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Popkin is one of the many advocates who support current laws in New York City, Seattle, and elsewhere that requires chain grocers to divulge calorie counts next to food listings. At least one city now requires restaurants to divulge even more information. Philadelphia, home of the Philly cheesecake, requires chain restaurants to list calories on menu boards, but sit-downs with written menus must also include information on carbohydrates, sodium, saturated fats, and trans fats. Though narrower federal law will preempt local laws, Philadelphia intends to petition for an exception, says Martha Johnson, the senior attorney for the city. Even outside Philadelphia, many chains will, upon request, provide written nutritional information to customers. A handout nutrition chart at McDonald's includes detailed tables on the saturated fat, carbohydrates, and more for everything from burgers to frappes. When you eat out, does all this nutritional information tend to confuse you? The headline read, Boston Company Ready to Acquire Hardee's. The corporate parent of Hardee's, the hamburger chain with a long history in eastern North Carolina, is changing hands. CKE Restaurants, which acquired Hardee's in 1997 and also owns Carl Jr.'s fast food chain, announced it had agreed to be bought by a Boston-based private equity firm for about $928 million. The takeover by Thomas H. Lee Partners, LP, comes as consumers cut back on eating out during the recession. And Carl's Jr. is heavily concentrated in California, which has been hard hit by the housing slump and soaring unemployment. Sales at CK restaurants open at least a year fell 6% in the last quarter. It's been a tough time for the fast food restaurant business, so valuations had to come down, Morningstar analyst R.G. Hatovi told the Associated Press. I think this private equity firm probably saw some opportunity. Body Knoll Enterprises of Rocky Mount is the largest Hardee's franchisee, operating 340 Hardee's outlets in four states. They declined to comment about the CKE acquisition. Thomas Lee will pay CKE investors $11.05 in cash for each share of CKE. The deal with Thomas Lee will benefit all of our stakeholders, including our franchisees and our employees, CKE Chief Executive Andrew Puzder said in a prepared statement. Yum Brands, the parent company of Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, are rumored to be interested in buying CKE, said Conrad Lyon, who follows CKE stock for Global Hunter Securities in Newport Beach, California. Thomas Lee was a part of an investment group that bought the parent of Dunkin' Donuts in 2006. It is likely that Thomas Lee is interested in trying to bolster breakfast sales at Hardee's by adding donuts to the menus and cross-promoting its brands, Lyon said. A private company would have more freedom to experiment with other changes, such as value menus, something Hardee's has mostly avoided, Lyon said. Speaking of fast food chains, fast food value menu wars have hit a new low, the $2 combo meal. Taco Bell announced plans to roll out $2 meals, deals that include a taco or a burrito, a medium soft drink, and a bag of Doritos. It's the only national chain selling an entree, side dish, and drink for $2. This is certainly thinking outside the bun, said Bob Sandelman, the CEO of the restaurant research firm Sandelman Associates. I'm sure McDonald's will be watching with interest. The restaurant industry has struggled through the recession and recovery to respond to consumer demand for cheap eats. Pizza Hut is selling any size pizzas for $10. TGI Friday briefly offered $5 sandwiches last year. Denny's recently rolled out $4 all-you-can-eat pancakes. Taco Bell's $2 combo meals lowers the bar for McDonald's dollar menu, where three items cost $3. If we had just tossed a pebble into the pond, the ripple wouldn't find its way to the shore, explains Greg Creed, the president of Taco Bell. We're throwing a boulder into the pond, and this will be a disruptor in the marketplace. Besides a medium drink and Doritos, chips, consumers choose from four items: chicken burrito, double-decker taco, gordita supreme, or five-layer burrito. Taco Bell will continue its 79, 89, and 99-cent value menu, Creed said. This is a way to reframe another point of value, he says. It's also a way to boost sales. Taco Bell's same-store sales were down 2% in the first quarter. More serious, sales of its combo meals, which peaked at 31% of all sales in 2008, were now down to 24% of all sales, Creed said. McDonald's says it isn't impressed. Our research shows we consistently rank among the best in the industry in consumers' perception of value, said spokeswoman Ashley Yingling. With many of us trying to maintain a comfortable weight, Desperation Dinner's authors Beverly Mills and Alicia Ross spoke about the alternatives to meat that can contain a lot of fat. She said, in the past we thought of TVP, which wasn't often. We always thought of chili and we always thought compromise. Using a vegetable-based substitute for meat felt like a last resort in our efforts toward vegetarian cooking. Not anymore. Textured vegetable protein, or TVP, also called textured soy protein, has come a long way in the past few years. For starters, Main Street companies like Boca and Morningstar Farms moved away from dried TVP toward easier-to-use and more palatable frozen crumbles that don't have to be reconstituted. And perhaps in their smartest move, the companies gave TVP a category name: recipe crumbles in the case of Morningstar Farms, or ground crumbles for the Boca brand. We suspect these names were to make TVP seem more mainstream and to conjure up the notion of ground beef. For us, the main draw of these vegetarian crumbles is the fact they're made of soy, and soy is extremely low in fat and high in protein. Now we have a real reason to experiment. Frozen recipe crumbles have gotten a flavor boost, too, with added spices such as garlic and onion. But some things don't change. When we think of textured protein, frozen or not, chili comes to mind. I may be tempted to try a package those crumbles in my next batch of chili. As we struggle with trying to keep from gaining weight, here are some suggestions that might help you win this battle. They come from an article by Suzanne Havilah Hobbs, whose column On the Table appears in Thursday's NO. Eat on a small plate. Use a luncheon-sized plate instead of a dinner plate for the main meal should result in smaller portion sizes. And you can have the appearance of a full plate, but you'll eat less and take in fewer calories. And this should help those of us who develop the practice of always eating everything on the plate. Don't eat before bedtime. If you've eaten supper today, it's likely the urge to eat again later is prompted by habit and not hunger. Many cues in our environment trigger conditioned responses. A favorite TV show, a calm moment in the evening, or relaxing on the sofa and reading the newspaper are activities I pair with a snack. Watch for your own cues. Over time, you may become conditioned to eat at those times, hungry or not. Break that cycle by breaking the habit. Eat small, less frequent meals, and don't skip breakfast. The rationale is you'll be less ravenous, lose control, and overeat. Eating snack-sized mini-meals several times a day rather than eating 1 to 3 big meals a day may help some people keep their blood sugar more stable and help defend off the munchies between meals. By never letting yourself get too hungry, you may head off impulsive binges on high-calorie foods like chips and cookies. Weigh yourself every day. There's nothing wrong with the practice for most of us, and keep close tabs on your weight can permit you to catch small gains and compensate by cutting back. By weighing in the morning, for example, an uptick on the scales may prompt you to choose a lighter lunch that day. Catching and correcting small fluctuations in your weight can keep you from gaining upward over time, and we all know it's easier to prevent weight gain than it is to lose pounds. Keep these tips in your toolkit and take them out when you need to try something new. They may be old, but they still work. Thank you, Suzanne. In another letter to editor, this question was asked. I keep bread flour to use in my bread machine. Can I use it instead of all-purpose flour in cakes, pies, and other baking? The answer, you can use your bread flour for other recipes, but you might notice a difference in results, particularly in toughness. Flour types vary in how much protein they contain. Protein is a part of what causes the development of stretchy bands called gluten, and gluten is a part of what gives structure to baked goods. When you see holes in baked goods, tiny ones in cakes, big ones in breads, that's because gluten creates a structure that can puff up when the bread is baked or when the yeast is in the dough emits gas. For bread, you want lots of structure to hold it up as it rises, so you use a bread flour, which is higher in protein and will develop more gluten. For cake, you want a lower, medium level of protein, so use an all-purpose flour and has less protein than bread flour. Before our next program, we will have celebrated the 235th birthday of our country on July the 4th, which this year comes on a Sunday. Take a few moments and thank God for all the people who have helped make this country great. We've run out of time with this episode of Thought for Food, and be sure to listen the same time next month. We hope you enjoy it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you.